the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Well, we've talked in previous weeks and indeed years on the Midweek Drive about the importance of foster care and how that really does impact to almost unimaginable aspects, how people can actually relate to each other, how our children, our most precious asset in many ways, can grow and develop into whole, wonderful, productive human beings. And we're continuing that theme today in terms of foster care and areas relating to foster care, specifically the whole notion of some of the reasons why people don't actually take this route in terms of misconceptions about fostering, being too old, having your own children, being single, working, living with a disability and so on. Well, somebody who can effectively address these areas very essentially, because she is a world champion, she's a general champion of life in so many ways, it's the fabulous Fatima Whitbread. How are you, Fatima?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on today. It's a great pleasure to, especially about a cause that's so close to my heart as well, and having had a lived experience for 14 years, and I'm very passionate about helping these young people. And today, obviously sharing my story, I hope that it will convince people out there that they should really be out there fostering for our young children and giving them a love and security of a safe home.
Well, let's just go straight into that, because most people will know you from your huge success and your championship and saying, well, it's all very well for Fatima to actually talk about this. She's done S, X, Y, Z, et cetera. Just talk about the whole notion of your experience as indeed somebody who was in foster care.
I was abandoned as a baby and some would say left to die. A neighbour heard a baby cry in a flat and hadn't seen anybody come or go in 2 days. So she called the police and they banged the door down and rescued the baby, which was myself. And then I spent the next 6 months in hospital with malnutrition and nappy rash. During that period, I was also made a ward of court by Hackney Borough Council. And I spent the next 14 years of my life in children's homes. The first 5 years was in Hertfordshire with 25 other children. And I can remember that vividly, that as I was growing up, there was a very strong feeling of emotional trauma. And, I was concerned, where was my mummy? Why was I there? And all the children there also were feeling emotionally disturbed. And we played in the front room often, where the toy room was, and it looked over the car park. And I can remember when anybody came into the car park, I'd always say, is that my mummy coming to get me? So it was quite sad in many respects, because for a lot of the children, they were constantly crying or rocking themselves to bed to sleep. And then also a lot of bed wetting and emotional disturbance as I said, so for me, it was no different. And as time went on, I spent, as I said, 14 years in the care system. So I've got quite a passion for being able to help these young children in the care system, using my lived experience and also using my Olympic platform to build, an awareness to where we can emphasize and relate to the public and create a platform for these young children to be seen and heard and their emotional needs to be met. And that's so key, because, for anybody that's listening in, why don't you open your heart and open your home to giving the child, a family, the love and the security and the stability that they need? I mean, every child has a right to a safe and happy childhood. And it would be marvelous if you could start to think about that and go online and tap into the national fostering groups. They will explain more to you how you can go about doing this and getting this process sorted out.
I mean, this brings us neatly round to our other special guest today, is the Chief Executive Officer of National Fostering Group. Of course, that's the wonderful Steve Christie. Steve, welcome to the programme. We're just listening, obviously, to Fatima's narrative there. I mean, I'm thinking, isn't this like, Annie in without Daddy Warbucks, and that it's a hard knock life, etc.? Obviously, that's fiction. That's a complete fiction. But actually, that very, very, in a sense, extraordinary life story. I mean, it's sadly, it's not unique, is it?
No, and there's a real crisis coming in children's social care, with the number of children coming into care is gradually increasing and has been for a number of years, for probably 10, 15, 20 years. And sadly, at the same time, the number of foster carers is reducing. And that's down to a few factors. I think the housing crisis doesn't help. So a lot of people who might have become foster carers, I'm not able to do so because birth children are still living at home, and some people are having to live in a smaller house than they perhaps would like. And that, combined with the employment situation in the UK, where there is sort of very little unemployment. And so therefore, people who perhaps would have chosen fostering as a way to earning a living, they're doing something different. And those two things, you know, it is a real crisis, and it has real consequences. You know, there are children out there that desperately need that loving home and that nurturing and care that we all take for granted, and they don't have that for reasons that are none of their fault. You know, they're just born into unlucky circumstances. And you know, so there could be somebody listening to this right now who's sat at home, and that person could put themselves forward to become a foster carer and could change the life of more than one child. You know, some of our foster carers they look after, you know, more than, you know, several children and over a number of years. So it's incredibly powerful, and each of those individual children, they just need a chance. That's all they need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this call for over 10,000 foster carers, initially you think, wow, how can we actually cope with that? I mean, as you said, a crisis in the whole aspect. 55% of councils across the nation have actually seen an increase in young people going into care. I mean, hopefully this will help to a certain extent, but do you feel as though we need more action, Steve, in terms of the way that we're viewing the whole foster care experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's so important for the future of society. You know, these children, that once they're given this background, they go on and achieve amazing things in life. You know, foster children, I mean, Fatima's living proof of that. You know, once she got that love and nurture of living in a family, she went on and had the whole country celebrating her successes and broke world records. And you know, that's just an example of what can happen if you give these children that chance that they need. And if you don't do that, and they go into adulthood and they haven't had a great upbringing, and they haven't had the childhood that we all deserve, then, you know, sometimes those children end up going into the criminal justice system, or they end up becoming homeless, or you know, it's so tragic, and you know, it's just storing up problems for our society in the future. So everything we can do to encourage people to become foster carers is incredibly important. And you know, there's lots of misconceptions around people, that people think they can't become foster carer because of a reason, and you know, the phrase that we use is, if you've got space in your home and the love in your heart, you can be a foster carer. And you know, if you think there's a reason you can't become a foster carer, then please, you know, make contact with us, or you can get hold of us online. We can speak to you. We can send somebody around. You can come to one of our sessions. We can introduce you to foster carers, and we'll deal with that. But there are no, very few fundamental reasons why people can't become a foster carer if they think it's something they would be able to do.
Steve, that was very eloquently put. Fatima, I'm going to turn back to you yourself, if I may, just to ask you if you have any words of final advice for people who might be listening to this, who might be in a sense, just they may never even thought of taking on board a foster role, etc. It is a huge responsibility, but what would you advise them to do?
Well, stop wasting time. Get online, as we said, and check out what it is that you can do in offering these children a safe haven, you know, an opportunity of experiencing the love and security of a family. And obviously, not only will they survive, they'll thrive. And it's all about working in collaboration as well. It can only benefit everybody if we have build happier lives, better communities and society as a whole. It's about time we started to think smart and do things on that level, because we're all just one step away from finding ourselves in that situation with the way things are. 4.2 million families already in poverty, 800,000 of them living on the food banks, 105,000 in children in the care system, 10,000 shortage of foster carers. What more could I say? So let's start to work together in collaboration, in partnerships, and let's try to help these young children, you know, build a legacy for future generations too.
I mean, I've got to say, Fatima, why don't you actually become prime minister? I vote for you. I mean, that would be critical if that's all you should run on that. Inspirational as well as a world champion piece from that point
well,
of view.
You can make me minister for children. I'll be quite happy to bang that drum. I think with lived experience that I've got, that I would have far more understanding for what's needed in terms of working in collaboration with the four nations across the UK. Fatima's UK campaign is out there already trying to work together to bring that voice together as one and use that platform to get that amplify the children's voices so they can tell you exactly what they want. Because if you listen to a child and you share that experience like you've heard of mine, it's the most empowering that you can have, you know, and hopefully that will inspire other people to realise that, yeah, why wouldn't they try and foster a child and give them that chance of survival and thriving in life? You know, because one day they're going to be an adult and they're going to want to have their family themselves. And we don't want history repeating itself. We want them to feel confident in their abilities to stand on their own two feet and to be able to provide for their families too.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steve, finally, if people remotely move to this side of things, National Fostering Group, as Fatima said, don't waste time, get online. She's a poet as well. It's genius. Any indication as to where you point them, Steve?
No, I mean, that's exactly the same information. You know, there's lots of information online, nfa.co.uk. The best thing to do is to get into conversation. So to click on the Inquire Now, and we can get somebody to give them a call, and they'll talk them through exactly what it needs to be a foster carer. But if you're thinking about it, then please, please reach out, and you could make such a huge difference.
Steve Christie, Chief Executive Officer of National Fostering Group, and of course the awesome legend. I mean, I couldn't be, you know, words almost fail me when discussing the awesomeness of Fatima Whitbread. Huge thanks. Take care. Keep on keeping on, and hopefully we'll speak again very soon in happier times.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Get online, you people.
One of the most profound phrases that seems to have stuck with me across the decades is the simple word, coughs and sneezes spread diseases. And that kind of really puts the fear of God into the whole notion in terms of how we should actually deal with the challenge of that irritating cough, that cough that you can't control, the challenge that actually strikes when you had a situation that you're just in the middle of doing a lecture, for instance, and suddenly you start feeling that tickly feeling. And once it starts, it almost becomes terrible to stop. I actually had to leave the actual room I was teaching in earlier this week when I had a coughing situation, because obviously whilst I was coughing into my hands, you know, enough already. I could go on and on. Let's find out the real answers for this by turning to a royal etiquette expert extraordinaire, and indeed royal butler, Grant Harold. Grant, welcome to the programme. How are you?
Hello, thank you very much. I'm very well. Thankfully not coughing.
Yeah, well, this is the key thing, because obviously we hear about coughing dodgers, haha. But this is a different form of cough, which clearly, I mean, I'm still quite shocked, given that we aren't that far out from the pandemic, that one still sees people actually not using hankies, not using hands, basically coughing into the general area, etc. This can't be good, can it?
Well, do you know, I'm really interested in this, because I've actually had a cough for the last few months, and I've only just got over it. And as we know, there's been this research that's been done by Convitia, who have these products, winter wellness helpers, which have basically got Munich honey, which I absolutely love, because that's one of the things I was taking to help my cough. I obviously take these products because I'm a bit like the, can I say, a bit like the king. I'm into my kind of traditional things, and it helped me, because I say through the summer, weirdly, through the summer, I had this cough that I just couldn't get rid of. And the thing that was embarrassing for me was especially in public transport. And the research that Kavita has actually done was really interesting, because it said that 17%, so a fifth of the adult country, sorry, 19%, a fifth of the country, was saying that that's one of the things, is they'll hold a cough within rather than cough, which I thought was quite, just to me, that seems a small number. And 16, I think it's 16% in restaurants, 40% in offices, 40% in public transport, think that's the worst place to have a coughing fit, which again, I just think the numbers, I was a bit surprised, because as you just said a minute ago, with everything that's just happened, you think, I would expect it to be a lot higher. I thought people would be a bit more paranoid about it, but obviously we're not, but I just think when it comes to common courtesy and politeness, you know, there is little things we should be doing to help spread, to stop spreading coughs and germs and diseases. And you'd have thought we'd all learned a big lesson from a couple of years ago.
And we know that there's this situation, it kind of always becomes like clockwork, in the time every 2 or 3 years when one has a cold, you get the cold, you get the runs, you get the sniffly things, and then that's going to be followed by the cough somewhere down the line.
Totally.
You know, I'm actually holding in my hand here a bottle of honey and Manuka plus vitamin C. So I kind of share that whole sort of notion that we've been through. But when you're getting better, when you're not sort of infecting things, just out of common respect, I mean, etiquette surely is about respect for our other fellow human beings. It's a case of not wanting to put them in an embarrassing situation.
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole idea. I mean, you know, this thing about if you do start coughing, be it a little bit again traditional, you know, you get the handkerchief for a gentleman, or even for a lady. But I mean, these days people say, "Oh, don't carry that." But I even carry, you know, this kitchen roll you get in our kitchens, and I take some of that out. Now I always carry that with me just in case, and because, you know, I always say that sharing is caring, but not your disease, you know, not your germs. You know, you don't want to start passing on your germs and colds and bugs and things to other people. So I think, you know, you can again got to use common sense. And I've been asked, would I hand my handkerchief to somebody else to use? I really have done that. Thankfully, I've been giving it back, because you don't really want me giving them all away all the time. But yeah, I mean, of course I'll pass it on to somebody else. And if you don't have anything, then it is that thing, it's not the best thing, but cough into your arm, because just don't just cough in somebody's direction or in their space, because that's just really bad manners.
Now, I mean, clearly, as a royal butler, you probably experienced all manner of things, some of which you can share, some of which you would never share in any way, shape or form. But have there ever been any incidents with members of the royal family, names remain silent, obviously, where you've seen them in difficulty because they've wanted to basically cough and they've had a coughing situation?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I've on many different occasions. Yes, I've seen them when they've suddenly started a cough and fettle before they're due to do a speech or meet somebody. Completely. And can I say? I mean, I don't think this is a big secret, or it might be a secret, but you know, I mentioned earlier on about obviously with Comvita and about the research they've done and about how I love their products. Well, one of the things about their products is they use Manuka honey. And Manuka honey is known for its help against inflammatory, or you know, obviously it's you know, different people get different views on it, but I'm a huge believer in it, and I think it helps combat all sorts of things. And the king is a lover of honey, absolute lover of honey, and I have no doubt that if he was going to have a cough and fit or something, he'd be reaching for that Manuka honey as well. And I should also quickly mention that when I worked in the household, I remember I was up in Fandrin, and I just finished the service for the night, and I had the worst cough and cold, and a member of his team said, "Oh, what you need is one of these hot toddies." And I was thinking, what in the S a hot toddy? Even though I'm Scottish, I don't know.
I was going to say that, surely. I'm even proud for a moment. I thought, wow.
Didn't even know. And as you probably know, it's hot water, lemon, a drop of whiskey, the vital ingredient, and of course, Manuka honey. And ever since then, I love Manuka honey. And I, every day, when possible, and I know some people say it's expensive, and of course it's expensive, but it's expensive for a reason. I try to take a spoonful of it, like Mary Poppins says, a spoonful of sugar. Well, probably not that great, a spoonful of sugar, but I take a spoonful of Manuka honey. And I honestly think it helps. And yes, I've had a cough, but I honestly think that helped get me through, because during my cough, I was actually on some cruise ships, I was doing public speaking, and I had to be able to carry on. And you know, so these kind of things got me through. But yeah, I mean, they're all family. Like all of us, they get bugs and things. And when they do, they obviously reach for the same similar things. And as I mentioned, the king's very traditional. You know, he's a believer in traditional methods. And, you know, I think I've been asked in the past, you know, about what he can take, what he takes. And that's where, you know, it's difficult
to say. That's perfectly understandable. We don't want the royal seal of approval.
No, exactly. But what I will say is he's a lover of honey, and I'm sure he's very aware of the benefits of what Manuka honey and some of the things can do for you.
Okay, we're going to wrap up with your top tips, and there are five of them, effectively, so we'll briefly go through them.
Five of them, yes.
Number one, of course, you'd say always cough into a tissue or handkerchief,
yes.
Not into your hand, sleeve, or indeed in someone else's direction. Yeah,
absolutely. So, as I said, sharing is caring, but not in this situation.
Yeah. And if there is a cough, of course, because I mean, this is an interesting one. I mean, I find it interesting looking back at that survey that people try to conceal the cough. Now, you can do it, but sometimes the act of concealing can make the cough a lot worse.
Yeah, I think it depends on how bad this cough is. If it's just a mild cough, then of course you can kind of conceal it. But you know, if you've got a full on coughing situation, you're not going to conceal it. That's the thing, and that's where you know you've got to apologise to the people near you and just try to cough out of their direction if possible.
Again, self-evident, surely post-COVID, don't shake hands with anyone or touch any shared surfaces until you've washed them thoroughly.
Well, see, this is the thing. You would think that was obvious, you know, that people would do that. You know, that there'd be you think that's not a problem. But 25% of people, again, with the Comvita survey, have said 25% have said they admitted to coughing the hands and not cleaning them afterwards. So again, it shows that people maybe it's because there's no water nearby or you know, whatever reason. But you can even get that little hand sanitizer you carry around with you. So I don't really think these days is an excuse not to be able to still clean your hands if you do that, and definitely don't shake hands. And in a worst case situation, do what the king does, the namaste, of your hands together and give that gesture.
And of course, if you do need to go out and you've got a cough, make sure you're equipped to take plenty of handkerchiefs, cough drops.
Exactly.
You need probably a small bottle of water as well, which again makes sense.
Exactly. That's what I would do.
And the final one, if you're next to someone who is coughing, possibly offer them some water if you've got them. If you've got some, and if needs be, a tissue. But again, you know, that handkerchief, you're quite right. I mean, I can see a scenario whereby you offer somebody a traditional handkerchief and they return it with mucus galore. That's not a good look.
That's the thing. And also, and I'm not just saying this, I mean, I also carry different things around with me, and as we've been talking about with Comvita doing this research, I actually carry the lozenges around, and if I can say, they are really good. They're really good, and as it's my mind, it's to do with the Manuka honey. And if I can convince you to go and to get some, Comvita.co.uk winter essentials, where you can find these. And as I say, I personally use them, and they're easy. The thing about though with lozenges and things like that, they're easy to carry around. So if you suddenly need to take something, it's handy. You know, that's what I like about them. And I say, it's not these kind of things, they don't suddenly make it disappear. But from my experience over the summer, it definitely helps make it easier.
Well, I think we managed to get through the last few moments without having any major coughing fits, but then we are suffering.
I know, which is good, which is really good.
Exactly. Comvita, as you mentioned, the best place to locate the survey details and indeed other materials. How can people follow your good self, Grant? Do you have a social presence?
I do. I have a small following of about 500,000 on, I think it's on Instagram, under the Royal Butler. So it's got one of those little blue ticks and lots of etiquette advice. So if anyone's looking for me, just look up the Royal Butler and you'll find all my websites and dare I say even TikToks as well. So.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've avoided X for obvious reasons, but that's another line entirely. Grant Harold, etiquette expert and Royal Butler, huge thanks. And stay cough-free, Grant.
Absolutely, likewise. Have a good winter without any coughs.
Well, no doubt there were huge celebrations in a certain part of North London last night, and probably the champagne corks are still being popped this morning as Richard Fitzwilliam's homeland won yet again for the third consecutive time by a single point. Yes, a single point, another match of the World Cup, which means that they are Rugby World Cup champions for the fourth time. Richard, I mean, I know you don't like to brag, but I mean, it's a bit much, isn't it? What with the cricket successes and the Rugby World Cup successes? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, I mean, 12-11, I think it was, and it shows it must have been knife edge. I didn't watch it, but frankly, I'm delighted. Yes, it's a good result in New Zealand. They might not necessarily agree, but yes, they've had a run of, it's not luck so much as, of course, skill, but luck always plays a part in these things. Yes.
It's possibly not going down as well as the 1995 victory did, but then again, sport and South Africans, the two things go together, even when you actually have a player booked. But unlike New Zealand, that wasn't upgraded to a red card. Never mind, this isn't a sports feature. Fia van den Bogert in the Netherlands. Have you ever encountered the Dutch Golden Age painter Frans Hals?
I have. One of his paintings hangs in the Mauritshuis in The Hague, and I've seen it there. So, of course. Well,
There you go, you see. So you're all fair with respect to this. Richard, are you a France Howell's secret admirer, or is it a case of far too many ruffles, far too many bold statements being put from that point of view, and frankly, not necessarily the kind of thing you normally like in an artist, even if it's in the National Portrait Gallery?
Well, yes, actually in the National Gallery, but yes, it has to be said, when I went to see this exhibition, I was rather surprised because there was practically nobody there. Now, that isn't the usual experience that you have with exhibitions. And the reason is certainly, I mean, he was a Dutch Golden Age master and he was truly remarkable. I mean, when you look at his portraits, the purpose of a portrait, I think, is to capture the character of the sitter. And I think he's done it in a masterly way. I think he was immensely skilled. He was based in Harlem. And indeed, if you wanted to be painted by him, you visited him. There's no doubt at all that what may have put some people off going is the fact that as you travel in this exhibition from room to room, you see a lot of subject beautifully painted, painted with skill, painted with perspicacity. You certainly see what you or I take to be their characters captured extremely well, down to the last ribbon or indeed the last fold of a garment. All of this he was superb at, but there is a certain austerity in the show. You can see some of it in the background now. People clad in black.
Sounds good to me, Richard. Sounds effectively where we should be heading for the new Puritanism, basically.
Do you know that you have touched on what I should have made the major feature of this comment? Because, yes, given some of your views on certain films recently, I think you would have fitted ideally into the society. But the trouble is, not very many people were at this show. Now, House is a remarkable painter. I mean, for example, if you look at the rather strange fact that his work, when he was 80, no less, was far, far less constrained. That is a particularly interesting part of the show. And the other is, when he painted figures, you could see their moods. Very often you don't find artists who, reasons, I mean, over the centuries, you don't find a large number of smiling individuals.
You tend How can to you keep a smile for an hour and a half to 3 hours, Richard? It's physically impossible. You know, it's not a selfie.
Well, of course, you could take a photograph, but he didn't have that capability. No, it's interesting if you look, for example, the rather wry, sideline glance of a sex worker, so a guy playing a musical instrument. When Franz Hals loosens up and when he captures a lot of figures in slightly more informal settings to the ones that you can see behind you, I think the exhibition is far more fascinating. But he was an amazingly skilled character. It's also got the Laughing Cavalier, which is, the most famous portrait on show, and also from the Wallace collection. I think it's the most famous portrait they have. So, yes, I mean, Franz Hals is an amazing artist. And curiously, the interest I hope will pick up. But there is this problem that, yes, that's a delightful portrait. And indeed, it's when the brush flows more freely that you feel that the fact that he's such a master in expressing himself, that can communicate, I think, more than the likes of Alex, for example.
It's grim, much too bright for me. I much prefer a more somber approach on life. Life is hard, then we pass away. That's what it's all about, really. Fia, from your own perspective, as a fellow Dutch citizen, given that obviously I think you were born just shortly after 1582, you might not have actually been in the whole sort of era of Franz Hals, were you constantly saying, Franz, lighten up, man, chill out, you know, just relax and just enjoy yourself?
No, I love his paintings. I mean, like Richard said, I mean, how he captures smiles in his paintings, which is a very difficult thing to do, especially if you have to let someone sit for many hours at a time, and those smiles like mostly turn into in grimaces, and he in his paintings you just don't see it. There are smiles, and there's so much joy in those paintings, and so many emotions, and I think that he did that very well. And I read a review about Frans Hals that said, yeah, no, he's not as good as Rembrandt. And like, yeah, of course. I mean, you don't need to compare the two. I mean, Rembrandt is of course known for his use of light, and I mean Frans Hals is different in that he shows those emotions, which in Rembrandt's painting doesn't show as much. So I think he's a great painter. I'm really fond of him.
Sarah Huntley, are you a Frans Hals fan, or is it a case of, well, once you've seen one Laughing Cavalier, frankly, my dear, you've seen them all?
Great, it is. It's really not type of art at all. I mean, I can understand how people like it, but personally, it's not for me. I'm more of sort of Lucian Freud, that type of art. I just find it all a bit chocolate boxy, if you know what I mean. And also, I don't know, I think it's time of year. I think it's so wet down in Cornwall. Perhaps my mood isn't the greatest, listeners, I'm sorry, but I need something vibrant and different and colourful and outrageous. And I think this is perhaps a bit too mellow for me at the moment. It's probably my mood reflecting on it, but I need vibrance, excitement, pampery, stupidity, fun, or
Perhaps a day trip
dramatic.
to Bucharest might solve a problem. Anna Coscodale, your first debut on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition, at least as far as our culture feature is actually concerned. Did Frans Hals make it to Bucharest? Or was it a case of don't be crazy, we've got enough of our own artists without importing Western Europeans?
I don't think it's a case of exposing only our artists, but unfortunately, he didn't make it to Bucharest. I think it's more popular in Western Europe, but nevertheless, we do learn about Western celebrities, Western painters, Western writers, and I do believe that in some history books, we do have special sections in which we do present painters from different countries and writers, and we do learn about them. So I do know a bit about him. I knew before, and of course, after that, I had to search it up and look.
Would you be checking out his exhibition though at the National?
Yes, I actually went when I went last year in London. I visited the museum, and I did see one of his paintings, and I've never been to the Netherlands, but I do plan on going this summer and next summer actually. So that's when I think I'll be visiting, and I can grasp a bit more of his paintings and what he's trying to express through it by seeing it face to face, not only through my laptop.
I mean, I'd certainly advise you to check out Balk in the Netherlands, if only for the wondrous world of korfball expertise that's actually there. But I'm just saying. Maybe you might also like to check out the joys of Cornwall as well sometime. But that's part of England, even, you know, the undead sometimes give a sort of pause for thought in terms of going there. But what they. Moving on. Richard, it's good to see that obviously we featured this the morning the royal butler who was talking about the importance of not necessarily getting caught up in sneezing and acknowledging the fact that even today apparently Prince Charles actually likes to use, oh sorry, King Charles likes to use honey in terms of a way forward with respect to his whole experience of experiences of life, etc. Do you have any particular cold tips that maybe Grant Harold, the royal butler, would like to add to his list?
Oh, he's a delightful person, Bethlehem indeed. He's absolutely right. King Charles does have a fondness for honey. I have to say that that is where our fondnesses diverge, because anything to do with honey makes I mean personally feel, shall we say, unwell. Well, does that
Wow.
fit your somber
I,
puritanical
if
expression?
you if you use the word, you know, just to throw up, that's fine. But I think it's you're using the wrong kind of honey, quite clearly.
Well,
Anyway,
anything to do with that.
Moving on, there's lots of different honeys available, as I'm sure, sir, you could actually wax lyrical on the joys and the importance of honey. That's, of course, when you're not actually deciding to actually throw yourself into the water and do a morning dip. But I have to ask, as we head off to this the next stage of Richard's review, given, of course, that you're not so much a water nymph, although people have actually argued that you could be a naiad, a dyad, and so on, have you ever considered actually swimming 100 kilometres across the oceans, etc.?
Oh, well, you know me, I love my wild swimming, which I have been doing. And I'd say it was quite picturesque with the rain teeming, like little pearl drops as you're out in the sea coming down. But yes, I would actually, I couldn't do that, but I would love to see whether I could, how far I could actually swim across. Where I am geographically, you can swim from one side to the other from Poi to Porun. I'd like to have a go at that. I think one of the things that would put me off is there is sometimes quite a lot of yuck in the water, and you wouldn't want to, you know what you're like, Alex. Rich's like on honey. So in your middle of swimming and there's nothing you can do about it, it's a bit like, ooh, and there was a rather large jellyfish the other day. But no, I can understand that. That film that you reviewed, which I loved, The Wild Swimmers, was...
Yes, and it's fair to say that this is close to being one of those decisions in terms of, after Richard's last set of reviews for Netflix movies, very nearly had me cancelling the subscription to Netflix. But in this particular instance, it seems as though it could be a bit of a life-affirming notion with Annette Bening. But Richard, talk us through your first movie of today, please.
Well, we have a movie, Naiad, and I think that this is a very pleasing film, and I think it's going to please those who go and see it, because it's a biopic, it's a sports drama, those interested particularly in swimming, but most especially it will attract admirers, and I count as one of them, of Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. I mean, they are what really appeals about this film, and again, this is... This particular series of characteristics, their tenacity when you want to do something, the fact that it's a story of endurance, the fact you never give up if you have a particular goal in mind, and the fact also the most particular point that the film emphasises is it's never too late, so it doesn't matter how old you are really, because in your midlife, and indeed in your early 60s, that is when Diana Nyad, who swam up to 30 and subsequently gave it up, she faced a variety of faces a huge number of difficulties in 110 miles swim without any form of protective cage from Cuba to Florida. No one has done it. Now, she thought she'd retired at 30. She needs a purpose in life. She has a best friend. There's a hint that they once had a relationship, but strictly it's a question of her being a Bonnie Stowell, played by Jodie Foster, is her coach and her best friend and her major support. However infuriating, however difficult, however totally frustrating, her determination to make the swim actually is. I don't think I ought to reveal how many attempts there are and what happens in every one of them, because that is the one...
Read the book. Find a way. Read a book. That's what it's all about. Read the book and then watch the film. Perfectly wonderful.
It's the aspect of it that has a certain drama. If jellyfish happen to attack or... I mean, all of this... It is quite an amazing feature. You've also got, as a navigator, it's very important because as you swim in this direction, it's very easy when you're swimming alongside and also being fed and given water on the boat, but equally you cannot leave the water. The whole point is you have to be in the water the whole time. Now, it's so easy to swim in the wrong direction. So the navigator is pivotal, and you've got John Bartlett, played by Rhys Evans, remember from Notting Hill and quite a large number of movies. He's likeable enough. But you've got the extraordinary tenacity of Annette Bening as Diana Nyad.
But her name actually means wood nymph. It means water nymph. As C.S. Lewis would say, when you talk about naiads, it's the fairy spirits of the water. So it was inevitable she'd succeed.
Well, I mean, Alex, I knew you'd give away what happens, and it is perfectly true that this film probably wouldn't have been made if it, I'm sure no
If she'd
one.
been stung by the first jellyfish when she'd sort of set out. No, clearly.
I'm sure, Alex, you want to go through the entire plot point by point so that no one gets any surprises. But the way, for example, what happens when a shark gets near, all of this, it will, this is a movie that will please an audience who quite rightly will realize that Ned Benning is excellent, that Jodie Foster is a fine support, Reese Evans does his stuff, and it's directed by a husband and wife team. It's their debut, Elizabeth Chi, Vassar Helley, and Jimmy Chin. So it's a movie for those who would enjoy this sort of film, and it's good. It's very good from that point of view.
Yes, I suspect you're going to waffle around about 6 or a 7 as opposed to what it rightly deserves, which is about a 9 or a 10. But never mind. Sarah Huntley, is this one for you?
May I just ask Alex why it deserves a 9 or
Because
a 10?
it's not got sufficient negative. Oh, I was going to say it's a positive life-affirming story, whereas you tend to go for the more dystopian approach.
I simply protest against this way. It's your individual. We're all different individuals. We score films in different ways for different reasons.
And
But
what did
this
you
is
give it?
a perverse, ideological, somber, Puritan approach.
And what did you give it?
No, I'll give it a 7.
There you
That's
go.
what I.
Sarah Huntley, is this
I
one
will.
for you?
Yes, because I'm intrigued by people who are captivated by water like I am. And therefore, yes, I would find it very, very interesting. And I think you've said something very important there, actually, Alex, that it's important that somebody has a quest, you know, to. It sounds silly, but just the fact I've been going swimming each morning. I don't know. It's helped with getting through lots of work and stuff like that. It's lovely to connect and talk to all of you. I need people. But yes, I think I'd like to go and see this film to see what I love these actresses. So I think they're brilliant. But also what the story is behind with their motivation and how it helps them. I would find that very interesting.
Well, it's available online from Netflix in a week's time. So there we are. Or even less if you actually listen to this on a Thursday morning, as probably you will be if you're a Siren Radio listener for the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on a Thursday, as opposed to when we record them, which tends to be Sundays. Fia, given that obviously Holland and water have a deep connection with all sorts of things, is this something which you think, yes, this sounds as though it's exactly what I want to go through after I've actually had my latest marathon run?
Well, maybe not for me, but I do think this movie is very interesting. Actually, recently, in the province that I live in, Frisia, there are 11 cities, and one person attempted to swim from city to city, which is 200 kilometers, and he also succeeded. So I think this is also, yeah, I mean, it's almost the same, but very interesting. So I would like to watch the movie, yeah.
Excellent. And Anna Koskinal, any thoughts on yourself, given, of course, Romania's fondness for swimming, or not, as the case may be?
I think this movie is interesting for me through the fact that she was able to live to fulfill her dream at any age because she didn't give up. And I think for that, because it makes you believe that no matter what you do in your life and how long you live and everything, if you still have a dream to achieve, you should fight to the end to make it come true. So through that's what will make me watch it actually.
And that's one of the reasons why Anna did all of the kind of running and coordinating for recent midweek drive. And I ignored it completely. And literally just sort of summed up the entire show. Never mind, Anna, your time will come with respect to that. It's all good. Just wanted to sort of publicly apologize for
Thank
that. So
you.
there you go. Anyway, moving onwards. Richard, Ken Loach. I mean, I think ideologically, he's not necessarily in favor of Rishi Sunak in any way, shape, or form, or indeed the current administration. And I think arguably his latest movie, which also brings to mind the plight of refugees in a YA, it's a northern accent pet, so let's go with that sort of routine scenario. Probably means that it's got to sit in a nice 9 out of 10 for yourself, I think.
Well, firstly, Kendo is a remarkable director. I mean, he is, as you mentioned, extremely political. He's a radical on the far left. In fact, I think he's been expelled from the Labour Party. I think he's 15 films in competition at Cannes, I think is a record. And also, two wins of the Palme d'Or. I don't think anybody's won more. He's won them for I, Daniel Blake, which is superb, and also Wind That Shakes the Barley, about the Irish situation, which also was superb. Though he's extremely political. Now, this is a very sentimental movie. You have to really appreciate it and enjoy it. Probably you've got to have, shall we say, share Loach's sentiments. The Old Oak is a pub in County Durham, and in the area was once thriving, but the mining communities, with the closure of the pits, they haven't got anywhere to hold meetings or whatever. Even the church hall doesn't exist. So the pub, an institution again, the Old Oak, which is the name of the pub, it's just holding on. The landlord, TJ Ballantyne, has had personal problems in the past. We see some of that through flashback. He relies on certain regulars. Now, the problem with these regulars is that they are an absolutely viciously racist bunch. And this comes out particularly when refugees from Syria are placed in their town. And when the landlord befriends one, and we have a nasty scene early in the film where a local smashes the camera of Yara, who played by Ebla Mari, who asks the landlord to see whether he could fix the camera, or indeed they befriend each other, and subsequently he gets a new one for her, manages to have the one she has fixed. It has a particular resonance because it's belonged to her father, who plays a certain part in this film as well. The whole thesis of this is the need to welcome others, and also the theme of solidarity, and also whether it's the
love thy neighbor as thyself, Richard. It's quite simple. That's all you need to do.
It is indeed. That is what Loach believes, and the photographs in the pub, they all of the miners' strike. As I say, it's a heavily political film. But what happens when, firstly, he won't lend the one room in the pub to those who want a protest meeting against the refugees? What he wants to do is, in fact, welcome the refugees and have those who are delighted that they're there, or those who want to meet them, open it up for the people, so as to speak. In the background, of course, you've got, you never see evil capitalists, but that's one of the reasons, or seen to be one of the reasons, them and the
That's because they're successful. If they're successful, you, of course, never see them.
But what happens when the particularly bigoted and vicious characters, and there are quite a few of them, what happens when they're denied the use of the room? So what do they do? Not very nice things. I mean, this is a film with its heart in the right place, but it's also got two extremely good performances. TJ Ballantyne as a landlord, a person of considerable sensitivity, also his known pain in his life, and also has Yara, played by Ebla Mari, and her community, and they're particularly concerned at the moment about her father and what his fate is in the regime's prison in Syria. Very good there, and also visually very very fine. It is very sentimental. The other point I'd make, I made this point, in fact, looking at, say, Hollywood Westerns, certainly those sort of movies that I grew up with. You could always tell someone who's bad by looking at them, because Hollywood typecast somebody like Lee Van Cleef.
And that's untrue, Richard. Unforgiven, for instance, completely blows that out of the water. So does arguably Pale Rider. The whole latter years of the whole thing.
But I said the films I grew up with, which was slightly earlier than that, Alex. This was
The Searchers, perhaps?
At the time of Lee Van Cleef and, say, High Noon, movie, or, for example, Shane, you would also remember them. I mean, one of the problems with this movie is that if you see someone who looks particularly vicious, horrible, nasty, they're a bigoted racist. Now, if you could only in real life spot somebody who's vile by simply looking at them, I think it would be, well, it would be very, make a life much easier to police. But yes, this is actually a rather, it's a likable film because the two performances and the fact that Ken Loach is so obviously sincere, whether or not you agree with him politically and the rest of it is another matter, you know, it is not one of his best films, but it is, it's well worth seeing.
Possibly one of his last. Anna Coscanell, given that you're probably going to have to use subtitles to begin to work out the northeastern dialects that's coming in this particular base, any thoughts on yourself?
Well, I do believe it's a very powerful movie. I can't say for sure if it's exactly my kind of movie, because given the fact and the reality that we live in, I tend to actually enjoy watching more happy movies with easy themes. But if I'm going to watch it and use subtitles, as you said, I think I will enjoy the performance, just how Richard said. And I'm just going to try to keep an eye on that and not to concentrate too much on maybe the negative aspects, because we are surrounded by them in our day-to-day lives. So, yeah.
That is often the case. Fia, what about yourself?
Well, I mean, I think this music film does so nicely is that many people, when they think of refugees, we always think in numbers and how many people come to Europe and try to find a home here. And I think this movie shows what a person, like a refugee is a person, and how a person is received in a village. And I think that's really great to show in a movie and for people to experience. Yeah. So I will definitely check it out.
And Sarah Huntley, shockingly, I don't believe you've ever been in a Ken Loach movie, but never mind. It may still be not too late.
He's only 87, Alex.
Well, I still hope. I suppose it wouldn't be my first go-to, because Ken Loach probably doesn't like people like me who are middle-class Southerners, but I do like his work. So I have to be honest, if I was choosing something, I think, that doesn't look a bundle of laughs. However, the subject is chosen, and exactly what the girls have been saying, very much of the moment. You should look at a human being as a human being, not whether they're a refugee, what minority they're in. So I think actually he does like to be pretty grim, but I think this film probably does have warmth in it, in the fact that hopefully, I don't know, but at the end of the film, hopefully the message is, you are the person you are, not whether you're what nationality or religion you are. And I think probably, I don't know whether it's just me, but everything I'm watching at the moment and things that have come out, you think, gosh, that's really ironic. That's the right word, with everything that's happening in the Gaza Strip at the moment, because it heightens just what this is about with Ken Loach. And so for me, yeah, I think I probably would see it, but this sounds awful of me. I think I need something to cheer my spirits as well. So I do the girls. I definitely would like to go and see it. And actually, I think Ken Loach has sort of come full circle, in fact. If he was making this film when there wasn't so much of this horrificness in the world going on, I'd say, oh, for goodness sake, can't you please make some film where it's a bit more lighthearted? But I can see the message behind it. And it's very interesting. I don't know whether the girls think it in their countries, but different parts of the countries, I think, have different levels of toleration of different people. And it's very noticeable when you're in small communities how they can be incredibly unaccepting and then accept. So I think it's a very interesting idea. has come up.
Not that we're going to have a major debate here, but Anna, clearly from Romania, which those of us of a certain vintage, Richard, Sarah and myself, can remember Ceausescu and the fun times he actually had over there. I mean, any thoughts in terms of Romania now? I mean, clearly we're delighted that you're over here doing a master's degree at the University of Lincoln and so on. But is Romania a welcoming place, or is it a case of, well, no?
No, I do believe Romania is a welcoming place. And I've spoke with a lot of students there that were international students and coming from other countries. And most of them said the same thing, that they feel welcome, that people are really friendly. Of course, there are cases like in any other place where they don't get along maybe with some people. But no, I do believe that Romanians in general are really friendly, welcoming people. They have a big heart. And I do believe that Romanian education system is really good. It's really good and put together. My choice of coming to the UK to study was based on numerous other factors, but Romania is really a wonderful country that I do hope people will start visiting it more and seeing it better than it's seen now in the media, because I know it doesn't have such great reviews all over the world, but we are really good people and we do not steal or do anything bad, I swear.
There we have it. So there we are, Richard. Forget your trips to Madrid and to the Netherlands and to Paris, etc. Hoy yourself over to Bucharest, as Ken Loach might possibly say. Fia, what about yourself? I mean, presumably it's a case of don't be ridiculous. Netherlands, we've always been welcoming. We're the home of democracy.
I mean, of course, yeah, no. Well, I mean, we are very welcoming to other people, of course, but I think there are also, I mean, like it shows in this movie, there is also a bit of fear, a lot of fear against the unknown and refugees coming here. So people aren't always as accepting of refugees here, but I mean, in my village, there are many refugees and now they are accepted because we know who they are and it's not as scary anymore. So I mean, just accepting is that helps. But at first sometimes we aren't as inviting, but overall we are very nice people. So Richard, yeah, you should come to the Netherlands, please.
Well, I love the Netherlands. I mean, Amsterdam.
Yeah, it's just Romania he has an issue with, but never mind. We can work.
I have no issue at all with Romania, but also, I mean, The Hague, fascinating. You mentioned the Mauritshuis, got to mention, and it's an absolute gem. They're remarkable. Yeah. I've actually been to every room now of the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. It's taken me several visits, but it's well worth it.
It's so big. Have you been to the other museums at the Museumplein?
Oh, yes. And I mean, there's so many good ones. The Museum of Amsterdam, of course, the Anne Frank House, which is so famous. And my favorite in Amsterdam, the Van Loon Museum, that rather extraordinary family, which, and they've dark sides of their past, but it's a wonderful museum and it's my favorite. Whenever I go to Amsterdam, I always call in there. And I think Willett Haverkamp Museum also is an interesting one because the house is kept up in the same way, just like the Van Loon, which is still lived in by the family, actually, in the way that, you know, that it used to be. And then the Rembrandt House. So,
and that's brought us full circle. And we started off with Fatima Whitbread and adoption, moved into the former royal butler and his views on honey, and then, of course, wrapped up with Richard Fitzwilliams, Anna Koskinen, Fia Vandenbogert, and Sarah Hunt. Keep watching those movies.